Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander & Associates, they pride themselves on providing their clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating their practice on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. And we are reading this week from the January 17th, 2020 issue of The Week magazine. This is our first new issue of the year. And the cover drawing this week shows a bundle of dynamite. And there is a hand that's coming in from the side. The cufflink suggests that it is President Donald Trump. And he's got a lit match in his hand, and he's lighting the fuse for the bundle of dynamite. The title is A Successful Strategy: How Trump's Killing of Soleimani Will Affect the U.S.'s Conflict with Iran. And I believe that is, in fact, our first main story. Iran stands down after Soleimani killing. What happened? America and Iran appeared to back away from the brink of war this week after the U.S. killed the nation's top military leader in a drone strike, and Iran responded by harmlessly firing 22 missiles at two Iraqi bases housing American troops. Following the exchange of military actions in which no Americans were killed or wounded, Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif said his nation had concluded proportionate measures in response to the killing of Major General Qasem Soleimani on January 3rd. President Trump said in a televised White House speech that the United States is ready to embrace peace, but announced new sanctions on Iran and warned its leaders against further hostilities or attempting to build a nuclear bomb. Despite the apparent de-escalation, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, Iran's supreme leader, said that the missile attacks were not sufficient revenge for Soleimani's death. Iran vowed to drive the U.S. out of Iraq, announced its withdrawal from the nuclear weapons deal it signed with six nations in 2015, and said it would resume enriching uranium without any limits. The crisis began when a pro-Iranian militia fired about 30 rockets at a joint U.S.-Iraqi base on December 27th. Wounding three U.S. soldiers and killing an American interpreter. 2 days later, Trump ordered airstrikes on five sites controlled by the Iran-backed militia Kataib Hezbollah, killing 24 people and wounding dozens more. That led to thousands of Shiite militia supporters storming the U.S. embassy in Baghdad, where they hurled Molotov cocktails and breached the compound's reception areas before withdrawing. After the embassy attack, Pentagon officials presented Trump with a menu of options and were stunned when he chose the most severe one, killing Soleimani, White House sources told the New York Times. Sources also told the newspaper that Trump feared the storming of the Baghdad embassy, which critics called Trump's Benghazi, had made him look weak. Administration officials said Soleimani was preemptively killed to prevent imminent attacks on Americans. But congressional Democrats who attended an intelligence briefing said the evidence of a plot was vague and unconvincing. What the editorial said. Soleimani's death is a great moment for the United States, said the Washington Examiner. As commander of Iraq's Quds force, he'd done more to destabilize the Middle East than perhaps any single figure, plotting terror attacks and training Islamic militants around the region. During the Iraq War, his fiendish roadside bomb campaign killed and maimed hundreds of U.S. soldiers. Trump's bold move puts the mullahs on notice that they will pay an outsized price every time they take action against U.S. interests and citizens. No one disputes Soleimani's blood-drenched legacy, said the Los Angeles Times. The question is whether America is safer and more secure now that he's dead. The price for killing is already steep. Iran has resumed its nuclear program. The Iraqi parliament called for U.S. troops to leave the nation. And the Trump administration undermined its credibility in Baghdad by sending a Pentagon draft memo to the Iraqis that said we were, in fact, withdrawing all our troops. In addition, the U.S. and NATO have suspended operations against ISIS in order to protect troops from possible attacks by Shiite militias and Iran. Clearly, Trump is winging it with Iran without having strategically thought out the consequences. What the columnist said, if Iran really does stand down, it will be a major victory for President Trump, said Philip Klein in WashingtonExaminer.com. By all accounts, Soleimani was irreplaceable to Iran as the architect of its efforts to extend Iranian influence throughout the region. By boldly eliminating him, Trump also demonstrated that America will not abide additional Iranian provocations. The cost-benefit analysis is not even close. Actually, the Iran crisis isn't even close to over, said Fred Kaplan in Slate.com. Instead of taking steps to de-escalate the broader conflict when Iran chose the off-ramp from war, Trump promised more sanctions and issued new threats to attack Iran. All concessions will have to come from Tehran. That won't happen, so further conflict is likely. It was Trump's failed policy toward Iran that created this mess, said Wendy Sherman in USAtoday.com. By taking the U.S. out of the nuclear deal negotiated by the Obama administration, Trump empowered Iran's most extreme hardliners, who have executed a string of provocations that include mining ships in the Persian Gulf, downing an American drone, and attacking a Saudi oil facility. Was the nuclear deal perfect? No. But Iran was abiding by its terms, and incremental progress always trumps chaos, which is what we have now. Nonetheless, Trump and his giddy allies are using Soleimani's death as a tool to batter his Democratic rivals, said Nancy Cook in Politico.com. Right after the drone strike, Democrats were united in accusing Trump of acting rashly, but in a theme echoed across conservative circles and airwaves, former U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations Nikki Haley said, the only ones mourning the loss of Soleimani are Democrats. With Soleimani dead and Iran apparently backing down without killing any Americans, Trump can pump himself up as a tough guy. Our controversy of the week, Democrats heading into Iowa, who has the momentum? Election year has dawned, the Iowa caucuses are less than a month away, and somehow the unsinkable Joe Biden still leads the race for the Democratic nomination, said Alex Seitzwald in NBCNews.com. Much like Donald Trump in 2016, the gaffe-prone 78-year-old Biden was expected to flame out early. Yet Biden, despite a predictable slew of unforced errors and out-of-touch comments on race and gender, not to mention President Trump's efforts to drag his son Hunter into the Ukraine scandal, enters the primary season with the support of 28% of Democrats nationally. That's down only a single point from where he announced from when he announced his candidacy. Biden's myriad liabilities still worry Democrats, said Eric Levitz in NYMag.com. He would be the oldest person by 8 years ever to win the White House, and the party's progressive base has not forgotten that Biden is implicated in many of the biggest policy failures of the present era, particularly his support for the Iraq War and the 1994 crime bill. Yet he has shown surprising resilience over the past year, managing the enviable trick of strongly appealing to both African Americans and working class whites. As long as polls keep suggesting that Uncle Joe is the Democrats' best bet for defeating Donald Trump, the nomination is Biden's to lose. Biden may still be leading, said Philip Klein in WashingtonExaminer.com, but Bernie Sanders has the momentum. Even after suffering a heart attack in October, Sanders has kept his dedicated following and has demolished all rivals in fundraising with $34.5 million in the fourth quarter of 2019. With rival progressive Senator Elizabeth Warren fading, Sanders now shares the poll lead in Iowa with Biden and Pete Buttigieg and leads the field in New Hampshire by 3 percentage points. It's time to stop treating the Sanders candidacy as a sideshow, said Jason Riley in the Wall Street Journal. If the Vermont Socialist wins one or more of the early primaries, many Democrats will start to question the perceived electability that is the foundation of Biden's support, and Sanders might emerge as the front runner. Before it's too late, Democrats should take a long look at Amy Klobuchar, said Steve Chapman in the Chicago Tribune. Not only is she female, a moderate like Biden, and a mere 59, but the same solid Midwestern pragmatism that made it hard for Klobuchar to stand out in a crowded debate could be very appealing to voters craving a president they can occasionally forget about. The wild card, said David Siders in Politico.com, is Michael Bloomberg. The billionaire businessman and former New York City mayor is apparently willing to spend limitless sums to defeat Trump. He's ignoring the early primaries and will pour his resources into winning on delegate-rich Super Tuesday and in the big state primaries that follow. If there's a protracted, bizarro world Democratic primary that produces no decisive winner, Bloomberg could emerge in this as the late consensus alternative to Biden and Sanders. If the race does drag on to the end, said John Fund in NationalReview.com, Democrats will be in serious trouble. The party is fractured between progressives and moderates and young and old, and all the candidates are having trouble convincing voters outside their base that they can win. Perhaps the party can heal its divisions at its convention in Milwaukee in July and unify by the fall. But in drawing this field of opponents, Donald Trump so far appears to be blessed with luck. We'll go into the good week, bad week segment. Seems it was a good week for painful sacrifices after designer Stella McCartney tweeted a photo of actor Joaquin Phoenix at the Golden Globes and praised him for having chosen to wear this same tux for the entire award season to reduce waste and help save the future of the planet. It was a good week for Nick Sandman, the MAGA hat-wearing Covington Catholic High School student whose stare down with a Native American elder at the Lincoln Memorial became a national obsession last January. Sandman received an unspecified settlement from CNN, which he'd sued for $275 million for vilifying and bullying him. And it was a good week for long attention spans. After author Robert Caro told the New York Times he's 604 pages into the fifth and final volume of his biography of Lyndon Johnson, but it's only up to 1965 in a saga that ends in 1968. It's going to be a very long book, said Caro. But it was a bad week for street cred, with the news that Death Row Records, the hip-hop label founded by Dr. Dre and the now jailed Suge Knight, is now a wholly owned subsidiary of the Hasbro Toy Company. Our businesses are highly complementary with substantial synergies and great cultural fit, said Hasbro chairman Brian Goldner. It was a bad week for trolling after Donald Trump Jr. posted a photo of himself holding an AR-15 rifle decorated with a Jerusalem cross from the Crusades and a decal of Hillary Clinton behind bars. A spokesman for Trump Jr. explained he enjoys triggering humorless liberals. And finally, it was a bad week for arts and crafts after two Mississippi men, Otis Latham and Russell Sparks, were charged with trying to claim a $100,000 lottery prize with a ticket whose winning numbers were glued on. And before we move on, here's a short news piece. FDA issues new vape restrictions. The Food and Drug Administration plans to ban the sale of sweet and fruity vaporizer cartridges, but anti-nicotine advocates say the Trump administration has capitulated to the e-cigarette industry. The new rules exempt menthol and tobacco flavors, as well as flavored liquids for open tank systems sold at vape shops. The banned flavors, favored by the roughly 5 million teens who vape, represented about 80% of retail e-cigarette sales last year, although industry leader Juul has already discontinued them. Teens also prefer pre-filled cartridges to open tank vapes. Yet after President Trump promised very, very strong action on vaping in September, he reportedly was dissuaded by lobbying, plus polling that showed a sweeping ban could hurt him in swing states. We're on the briefing page. Title this week, Taking the Beef Out of Burgers. Sales are booming for alternative meats. Are plant-based burgers just a fad? Why are meatless burgers so popular? Food scientists believe they've achieved a kind of alchemy, making plants look and taste like meat. Global sales suggest they've largely succeeded. All plant burgers, nuggets, meatballs, and sausage patties exploded in popularity last year, driven by California-based Beyond Meat and Impossible Foods. Beyond had 2019's most successful IPO and gained a presence in 20,000 U.S. grocery stores, plus 53,000 fast food restaurants such as Dunkin' Donuts and Carl's Jr., while McDonald's is testing a Beyond Burger in Canada. Burger King's Impossible Whopper and White Castle's Impossible Sliders were almost too successful, causing a supply crisis. Overall, U.S. restaurant sales of plant-based meat grew by 400% last year. Combine those with supermarket sales, and consumers spent nearly $1 billion on these products in 2019. Plant-based burgers attract eaters who are health-conscious and or environmentally concerned, but aren't willing to give up familiar taste and textures for quinoa and seitan. 95% of Impossible's customers eat meat. In taste tests, half of them can't tell Impossible burgers from the real thing. What's their secret? Meat analogs such as tofu go back 2,000 years, but these are not your father's frozen veggie burgers. The new faux burgers are engineered to imitate the way ground meat sizzles on the grill, bleeds in the middle, and crumbles in your mouth. That's no small feat, considering cooked beef contains 4,000 different molecules, about 100 of which create its smell and umami-rich flavor. Impossible Food simulates that pinkish color and savory flavor with heme, an iron-carrying molecule in blood, and some plant roots. The heme is created by genetically modifying yeast with soy DNA in gigantic tanks. What else are they made of? The new burgers vary in composition, but are largely made of plant proteins, usually soy, but sometimes pea, bean, or wheat, and plant fats. These ingredients are cooked in big pressure cookers, which use low heat and compression to replicate the fibrous texture of meat. The first challenge in creating a plant-based burger is to make a tasteless patty, getting rid of so-called off flavors. Pea protein is said to taste of urine. Once we crack the code on meat flavor, said Impossible Food scientist Laura Kleiman, if you change a few of the ratios and ingredients, it's not that hard to get fish or pork or chicken. Impossible Burgers have 21 ingredients, mostly soy and potato proteins, plus coconut and sunflower oils. Beyond Burgers have 18 ingredients, a mixture of isolated pea protein, mung bean, and rice proteins. Beetroot juice provides the bleeding effect. The thickener, methyl cellulose, potato starch for texture, and the salt substitute potassium chloride are also used. Beyond Burgers get the marbled look of ground beef from the coconut oil and cocoa butter whipped into tiny globules of fat. Is that healthier than meat? Yes and no. Consuming meat is believed to increase the risk of cardiovascular disease and colorectal cancer, and humans can develop unsafe resistance to antibiotics by eating animals fed those drugs. Commercial beef, pork, and poultry often carry bacteria and viruses from fecal matter and cause illness if not properly cooked or handled. Critics of alternative meat, however, say that companies are exploiting the healthy sound of plant-based while providing heavily engineered products. Whole Foods CEO John Mackey, for example, has warned customers that these burgers are super highly processed foods. Meatless burgers are cholesterol-free and contain about the same calorie count as hamburgers, but have more sodium. The Impossible Whopper has 1,240 milligrams of sodium, 260 more than the beef version. Coconut oil gives Beyond and Impossible Burgers saturated fat levels similar to beef. And their proteins are considered less nutritious. Impossible's recipe depends on soy, which can mimic estrogen in the body, but food scientists say it's safe to consume in moderate quantities. Is the meat industry alarmed? Stanford University biochemist Patrick Brown, who founded Impossible Foods, says it should be. We plan to take a double-digit portion of the beef market within 5 years, he said, and then we can push that industry, which is fragile and has low margins, into a death spiral. That's unlikely. Americans, on average, eat 3 hamburgers a week, and the combined annual revenue of the 3 largest U.S. meatpacking companies is about $200 billion. Still, the meat industry clearly feels threatened. Lobbyists convinced 12 state legislatures last year to ban products from using words such as burger and meat if they don't come from animals. But to hedge their bets and to take advantage of the boom, Purdue, Nestle, Kellogg, and meat giant Tyson Foods are developing their own plant-based or hybrid burgers. As Tyson's former CEO Tom Hayes said, if you can't beat them, join them, right? It's time for a few of the best columns of the week. We'll start with two from the U.S. The first one from David Lenhart at the NewYorkTimes.com says, presidential primaries are broken. Let's face it, the presidential nominating process is absurd, said Dave Lenhart. Currently, the Democrats' 7 leading candidates include 3 in their 70s, 2 businessmen who've never held any elective office, Andrew Yang and Tom Steyer, and Mayor Pete Buttigieg, who has never won more than 10,991 votes in an election. Why have they outlasted more accomplished governors and senators? Both the Democrats and Republicans greatly diminished the influence of party leaders in the 1970s, but the supposedly more democratic process now in place has come to resemble a reality television show. Debate gaffes and one-liners, polls and fundraising determine who survives. With a small number of highly partisan voters in early primary states, often choosing a nominee who most people don't want. That's how Donald Trump, then loathed by at least half of Republican voters and nearly all GOP leaders, hijacked the nomination in 2016. In the past, the parties had a big incentive to choose a broadly liked candidate, which is how we wound up with nominees such as Abraham Lincoln, both Roosevelts, and Dwight Eisenhower. I'm not suggesting we return to the smoke-filled rooms of the past, but major reform is needed. Admiring a fantasy Russia. We are experiencing a curious new phenomenon, said Anne Applebaum. Right-wing nationalists who disdain America and admire Russia. Disgusted by multiculturalism, the decline of religion, and what they believe is the degeneracy of American society, some conservatives and evangelicals now see in Russia the shimmering lure of a unified, homogeneous nation that has resisted change and political correctness. Alt-right Godfather Patrick Buchanan has been lavishly praising Russian President Vladimir Putin, pointing to Putin's promotion of Orthodox Christian symbolism, anti-gay policies, and traditional values. Fox News host Tucker Carlson, a white nationalist who has wondered, how precisely is diversity our strength? Even said he was rooting for Russia in its conflict with Ukraine. But if these Putin fans actually experienced the reality of Russia, they'd be horrified. Only 15% of Russians say religion plays an important role in their lives. The country has one of the highest abortion rates in the world. Russia's percentage of Muslims is six times higher than ours, and one of its provinces, Chechnya, is officially ruled by Sharia law. Putin's American fans hate modern America, so they pine for a fantasy nation that does not exist. This is a column from Austria. A new model for green conservatism. Austria's Conservative People's Party and the leftist Greens agreed to form a coalition government last week, said Andreas Kohl. And this bizarre political marriage just might work. The deal comes 7 months after the last government headed by People's Party leader Sebastian Kurz collapsed in scandal when the leader of his junior coalition partner, the far-right Freedom Party, was caught on camera soliciting bribes from a purported Russian oligarch. The Freedom Party and the center-left Social Democrats were trounced in September's snap elections, leaving the People's Party and the Greens as the two big winners. In years past, an alliance between these ideological opposites would have been out of the question. But the Green Party is no longer focused on far-left social policies that are red flags for conservatives. Instead, its key goal is to mitigate climate change, and that's something the People's Party can get behind. Today's Austrians take for granted both the welfare state and the market economy, which means old left-right divisions aren't as stark as they once were. Instead, both sides want to tackle global warming, control immigration, and reform education. So Kurz, 33, will once again be chancellor and the world's youngest national leader. And Austria's coalition of odd bedfellows could become a model for Europe. Our in-depth article, The Last Word, is titled this week, Learning to Accept Your Decline. All the evidence suggests that your skills and professional achievements will peak much sooner than you expect, said Arthur Brooks in The Atlantic. If you want to avoid irrelevance and bitterness, start planning for that now. It's not true that no one needs you anymore. These words came from an elderly woman sitting behind me on a late-night flight from Los Angeles to Washington, D.C. The plane was dark and quiet. A man I assumed to be her husband murmured almost inaudibly in response, something to the effect of, "I wish I was dead." Again, the woman. "Oh, stop saying that." I didn't mean to eavesdrop, but couldn't help it. I listened with morbid fascination, forming an image of the man in my head as they talked. I imagined someone who had worked hard all his life in relative obscurity, someone with unfulfilled dreams, perhaps of the degree he never attained, the career he never pursued, the company he never started. At the end of the flight, as the light switched on, I finally got a look at the desolate man. I was shocked. I recognized him. He was, and still is, world famous. Then, in his mid-80s, he was beloved as a hero for his courage, patriotism, and accomplishments many decades ago. As he walked up the aisle of the plane behind me, other passengers greeted him with veneration. Standing at the door of the cockpit, the pilot stopped him and said, "Sir, I have admired you since I was a little boy." The older man, apparently wishing for death just a few minutes earlier, beamed with pride at the recognition of his past glories. For selfish reasons, I couldn't get that scene out of my mind. It was the summer of 2015, shortly after my 51st birthday. I was not world famous like the man on the plane, but my professional life was going very well. But I had started to wonder, can I really keep this going? I work like a maniac, but even if I stayed at it 12 hours a day, 7 days a week, at some point my career would slow and stop. And when it did, what then? Would I one day be looking back wistfully and wishing I were dead? Though these questions were personal, I decided to approach them as a social scientist I am, treating them as a research project. It felt unnatural, like a surgeon taking out his own appendix, but I plunged ahead, and for the past 4 years, I have been on the quest to figure out how to turn my eventual professional decline from a matter of dread into an opportunity for progress. Here's what I've found. The field of happiness studies has boomed over the past 2 decades, and a consensus has developed about well-being as we advance through life. In The Happiness Curve, Why Life Gets Better After 50, Jonathan Rauch reviews the strong evidence suggesting that the happiness of most adults falls through their 30s and 40s, and then bottoms out in their early 50s. So what can people expect after that, based on the data? The news is mixed. Almost all studies of happiness over the lifespan show that in wealthier countries, most people's contentment starts to increase again in their 50s until age 70 or so. That is where things get less predictable, however. After 70, some people say stay steady in happiness. Others get happier until death. Others, men in particular, see their happiness plummet. Indeed, depression and suicide rates for men increase after age 75. Giftedness and achievements early in life do not appear to provide an insurance policy against suffering later on. In fact, abundant evidence suggests that the waning of ability in people of high accomplishment is especially brutal psychologically. "Unhappy is he who depends on success to be happy," Alex Divas Ribeiro, a former Formula One race car driver, once wrote. For such a person, the end of a successful career is the end of the line. His destiny is to die of bitterness or to search for more success in other careers and to go on living from success to success until he falls dead. In this case, there will not be life after success. There are plenty of examples of this. Take Charles Darwin, who was just 22 when he set out on his five-year voyage aboard the Beagle in 1831. Returning at 27, he was celebrated throughout Europe for his discoveries in botany and zoology, and for his early theories of evolution. Over the next 30 years, Darwin took enormous pride in sitting atop the celebrity scientist pecking order, developing his theories and publishing them as books and essays, the most famous being On the Origin of Species in 1859. But as Darwin progressed into his 50s, he stagnated. He hit a wall in his research. Depressed in his later years, he wrote to a close friend, "I have not the heart or strength at my age to begin any investigation lasting years, which is the only thing which I enjoy." I have had precocious experiences with professional decline. As a child, I had just one goal, to be the world's greatest French horn player. I worked at it slavishly, practicing hours a day, seeking out the best teachers, and playing in any ensemble I could find. I had pictures of famous horn players on my bedroom wall for inspiration, and after a while, I thought my dream might come true. At 19, I left college to take a job playing professionally in a touring chamber music ensemble. But then, in my early 20s, a strange thing happened. I started getting worse. To this day, I have no idea why. My technique began to suffer, and I had no explanation for it. Nothing helped. I visited great teachers and practiced more, but I couldn't get back to where I had been. Pieces that had been easy to play became hard. Pieces that had been hard became impossible. Perhaps the worst moment in my young but flailing career came at age 22, when I was performing at Carnegie Hall. While delivering a short speech about the music I was about to play, I stepped forward, lost my footing, and fell off the stage into the audience. On the way home from the concert, I mused darkly that the experience was surely a message from God. But I sputtered along for 9 more years. I took a position in the City Orchestra of Barcelona, where I increased my practicing, but playing gradually deteriorated. Finally, I had to admit defeat. I was never going to turn around my faltering career. So at 31, I gave up, abandoning my musical aspirations entirely to pursue a doctorate in public policy. I am lucky to have accepted my decline at a young enough age that I could redirect my life into a new line of work. Still, to this day, the sting of that early decline makes these words difficult to write. I vowed to myself that it wouldn't ever happen again. Will it? The odds are that it will. In fact, the data are shockingly clear that for most people in most fields, decline starts earlier than almost anyone thinks. According to research by Dean Keith Simonton, a professor emeritus of psychology at the University of California, Davis, and one of the world's leading experts on the trajectories of creative careers, success and productivity increase for the first 20 years after the inception of a career, on average. So if you start a career in earnest at 30, expect to do your best work around 50 and go into decline soon after that. The specific timing of peak and decline varies somewhat depending on the field. Age is, of course, a fever chill that every physicist must fear. He's better dead than living still when once he's passed his 30th year. The author of those gloomy lines? Paul Dirac, a winner of the 1933 Nobel Prize in Physics. Dirac overstates the point, but only a little. Entrepreneurs, too, peak and decline early on average. After earning fame and fortune in their 20s, many tech entrepreneurs are in creative decline by age 30. Are there outliers? Of course, but the likelihood of producing a major innovation at age 70 is approximately what it was at age 20, almost non-existent. This research concerns people at the very top of professions that are atypical. But the basic finding appears to apply more broadly. In sum, if your profession requires mental processing speed or significant analytic capabilities, the kind of profession most college graduates occupy, noticeable decline is probably going to set in earlier than you imagine. Sorry. If decline not only is inevitable but also happens earlier than most of us expect, what should we do when it comes for us? Consider the case of Johann Sebastian Bach. Born in 1685 to a long line of prominent musicians in central Germany, Bach quickly distinguished himself as a musical genius. Early in his career, Bach was considered an astoundingly gifted organist and improviser. Commissions rolled in, royalty sought him out, young composers emulated his style. But it didn't last, in no small part because his career was overtaken by musical trends ushered in by his own son, Carl Philipp Emanuel, known as CPE to the generations that followed. As classical music displaced Baroque, CPE's prestige boomed while his father's music became passé. Bach easily could have become embittered, like Darwin. Instead, he chose to redesign his life, moving from innovator to instructor. He spent a good deal of his last 10 years writing The Art of Fugue, not a famous or popular work in his time, but one intended to teach the techniques of the Baroque to his children and students, and, as unlikely as it seemed at the time, to any future generations that might be interested. When Darwin fell behind as an innovator, he became despondent. His life ended in sad inactivity. When Bach fell behind, he reinvented himself. He died beloved, fulfilled, though less famous than he once had been, respected. The lesson for you and for me, especially after 50, be Johann Sebastian Bach, not Charles Darwin. At some point, writing one more book will not add to my life satisfaction. It will merely stave off the end of my book writing career. The canvas of my life will have another brushstroke that, if I am being forthright, others will barely notice and will certainly not appreciate very much. The same will be true for most other makers, markers of my success. I suspect that my own terror of professional decline is rooted in a fear of death, a fear that, even if it is not conscious, motivates me to act as if death will never come by denying any degradation in my professional abilities. What New York Times columnist David Brooks calls resume virtues. This denial is destructive because it leads me to ignore ethical and spiritual ideals. For Brooks, the eulogy virtues, that brings me the greatest joy. How can I overcome this tendency? The Buddha recommends, of all things, corpse meditation. Many Theravada Buddhist monasteries in Thailand and Sri Lanka display photos of corpses in various states of decomposition for the monks to contemplate. At first, this seems morbid, but its logic is grounded in the psychological principles, and it's not an exclusively Eastern idea. To begin depriving death of its greatest advantage over us, Michel de Montaigne wrote in the 16th century, let us deprive death of its strangeness. Let us frequent it. Let us get used to it. Let us have nothing more often in mind than death. For most people, actively contemplating our demise so that it is present and real rather than avoiding the thought of it via the mindless pursuit of worldly success can make death less frightening. Decline is inevitable, and it occurs earlier than almost any of us wants to believe. But misery is not inevitable. Accepting the natural cadence of our ability sets up the possibility of transcendence, because it allows the shifting of attention to higher spiritual and life priorities. The aim and final end of all music, Bach once said, should be none other than the glory of God and the refreshment of the soul. Whatever your metaphysical convictions, refreshment of the soul can be the aim of your work. like Box. When I talk about this personal research project I've been pursuing, people usually ask, whatever happened to the hero on the plane? I think about him a lot. He's still famous, popping up in the news from time to time. Early on, when I saw a story about him, I would feel a flash of something like pity, which I now realize was really only a refracted sense of terror about my own future. Poor guy really meant I'm screwed. But as my grasp of the principles laid out in this essay has deepened, my fear has declined proportionately. My feeling toward the man on the plane is now one of gratitude for what he taught me. I hope that he can find the peace and joy he is inadvertently helping me to obtain. A version of this article originally appeared in The Atlantic. We'll pick up a technology article now and then one or maybe two of the health and science pieces. So, data. Can we ever be anonymous again? Millions of Americans are carrying spies in their pockets during the day and leaving them beside their beds at night, said Stuart Thompson and Charlie Wartzel in the New York Times. We obtained a gigantic file from just one of the dozens of data firms in existence, and it held more than 50 billion location pings from the phones of more than 12 million Americans from a period of several months in 2016 and 2017. And while these tracking companies typically justify their business by saying that people consent to be tracked, the data is anonymous and the data is secure, those claims don't hold up. In most cases, ascertaining a home location and an office location was enough to identify a person. We tracked a Microsoft employee who changed his routine commute one day to visit the headquarters of Amazon. The following month, he started a new job at Amazon. All of this collection is perfectly legal and profitable. Many buyers have little to do with consumer advertising, including the financial institutions, geospatial analysis companies, and real estate investment firms. Even scarier, it took only minutes for us to track the whereabouts of President Trump, thanks to location pings from the smartphone of a Secret Service agent. Only the paranoid survive, said Kara Swisher, also in the Times, which is why I recently switched all of the location access buttons on my iPhone from while using to the app to ask next time. It's up to us to protect ourselves. With a federal law, the best security we have is the California Consumer Privacy Act, CCPA, which went into effect January 1st. You may have already started noticing a small button or link at the bottom of websites you visit that says, "Do not sell my personal information," said Aaron Mack in Slate.com. The only tech firms in California, home of Silicon Valley, are required to give users this option. Some companies are adopting the new rule nationwide. Google has already begun adjusting its protocols for data, but Facebook is arguing that it does not need to change anything because its collection doesn't constitute selling under state law. In reality, transparency goes only so far, said Jeffrey Fowler in the Washington Post. My inbox is already flooded with updated privacy policies and data disclosures, thanks to the CCPA, and I can't handle all of it. One bright sign, the next year could bring a new wave of data privacy apps, joining the likes of password managers and security-focused Wi-Fi routers. These apps, for example, Jumbo, log into your platforms and spruce up your privacy on your behalf, quickly identifying a half dozen privacy settings for Facebook and Google that even I missed. A face from ancient gum. Scientists have recreated the face of an ancient hunter-gatherer using DNA extracted from a piece of chewing gum that was spat out some 5,600 years ago. The lump of chewed birch tar was found at a site in southern Denmark, alongside pieces of wood and wild animal bones. Made by heating birch tree bark, the tar has been employed as an adhesive for hundreds of thousands of years. Neolithic humans used the sticky substance to glue arrowheads to arrow shafts and repair stone tools. Many pieces of tar found at archaeological sites contain tooth marks, suggesting the gum, which has an antiseptic properties, was also used to treat tooth pain. From the Danish sample, researchers were able to recreate the entire genomic sequence of the chewer, a woman who had dark skin, dark hair, and blue eyes. It is the first time that scientists have extracted an entire human genome from anything other than human bones. There are periods where we don't have any bones, but birch pitch survives very well, study co-author Thijs Jensen tells The Guardian. It's very intimate. You get so much information. And we'll go right on over to the Talking Points page. We'll start with an article titled Golden Globes, Gervais Skewers Hollywood. Ricky Gervais finally said what everyone outside Tinseltown has been thinking, said Emily Jahinski in TheFederalist.com. The subversive British comic's hosting turn at Sunday's Golden Globes deserves to go down in award show history for his savage takedown of Hollywood's liberal sanctimony. You know nothing about the real world, Gervais told the assembled stars. So if you win, come up, accept your little award, thank your agent and your God, and blank off. As actors gaped in astonishment, Gervais mocked their hypocrisy for lecturing the public while making movies and cable shows for the likes of sexual predator Harvey Weinstein, minimum wage specialist Amazon, and Apple, a company that runs sweatshops in China. For all comics who claim to speak truth to power, this is how it's done, said Kyle Smith in the New York Post. Gervais hilariously exposed the divide between Hollywood's preening self-regard and what the rest of the world sees, a gang of pretentious jerkwads who mistakenly think their insights on world affairs matter. Gervais' cynical malevolence was painful to watch, said Sophie Gilbert in TheAtlantic.com. For entertainers to raise their voices at such a dark time for our country was entirely appropriate, from Michelle Williams defending abortion rights to Patricia Arquette voicing fear of war with Iran to Russell Crowe linking climate change to the wildfire devastation in his native Australia. Gervais' tired agitator shtick smacked of nihilism, said Lorraine Ali in the Los Angeles Times. With impeachment looming, possible war in the Middle East, and Australia ablaze, the last thing anyone needed was for the smirking master of ceremonies to reprimand them for having hope, or taunt the room for trying to use their influence to change things for the better. In a polarized country, Gervais' subversive assault on Hollywood served as a political lightning rod, said Tiana Lowe in WashingtonExaminer.com. Conservatives were gleeful. The left started hand-wringing. But Gervais, who has mocked President Trump as stupid and arrogant, is actually apolitical. He is honest. Bracing comedy is part of a venerable tradition, reminiscent of the ancient Greek chorus or the court jester, holding the powerful to account. Presumably, the most lauded actors in the country have some familiarity with the role of fools challenging kings in Hamlet and King Lear, even if they had to spark notes it. Got some shorter notes here, starting with 41 mass killings, defined as an event in which four or more people die, excluding the perpetrator, occurred in the U.S. during 2019, the most of any year since the 1970s. In all, 211 people died, fewer than the 224 tallied during 2017, when a gunman killed 58 people in Las Vegas. Border Patrol agents apprehended citizens of more than 100 countries around the world attempting to cross America's southern border in 2018, including almost 9,000 Indians, 1,000 Chinese nationals, 250 Romanians, 153 Pakistanis, 159 Vietnamese, 15 Albanians, 3 people each from Syria and Taiwan, and 2 North Koreans. Women who have health insurance pay an average out-of-pocket cost of $4,500 for the delivery of a baby, according to a study of 657,000 women by the University of Michigan researchers. Those costs are largely the result of higher deductibles as employers shift the soaring expense of health care onto employees. Chelsea Clinton has received $9 million in salary and stock compensation since 2011 for serving on the board of internet investment company IAC Interactive Corp. IAC Interactive Corp is controlled by business mogul Barry Diller, a longtime friend of the Clintons. And we'll finish out the show today with a quote from Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan, quoted in the Washington Post, who says, "Ideological certainty easily degenerates into an insistence upon ignorance." We have run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. I'm Fred Woodward, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program was generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander & Associates, they pride themselves on providing their clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating their practice on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please give us a call, 919-832-5138.